Winter is upon us and Tesla is now a part of the S&P 500. What does it mean for the index going forward? And some good news for banks as the Fed is now allowing them to increase their buybacks going forward because of their stress test. And Microsoft getting into semiconductors, putting some pressure on Intel. That stock was down 6% Friday. This is the Market Wake Up. I'm Jared Guitry, along with Javier David and Emily McCormick. All right, straight to the markets because guess what? After all the fanfare, all the lead up, Tesla is now part of the S&P 500. And guess what? Not a lot happened on Friday afternoon. There was a lot of speculation that there might be some kind of market turbulence given what was happening with the stock itself, such a large issue, $650 billion, kind of unprecedented to be added to an index. And there was some expected selling in some other big stocks like Microsoft, Berkshire Hathaway, Johnson & Johnson, but not too much. So all in all, kind of went out without a hitch here. And we're also looking forward to the rest of the year here, maybe a Santa Claus rally. We've got two holiday shortened weeks. We got Christmas at the end of this week, New Year's at the end of the next. So only 8 trading days left in the year. And this is typically the most bullish time of year when we just kind of get that slight little drift to the upside. But of course, we got the stimulus overhang and everybody's on pins and needles to see what happens with that. And that's going to be the big market mover of the week. We'll definitely be on the alert for more details today. But I want to get to you, Emily. I know you're watching a couple stocks. Nike just reported some earnings on Friday afternoon, and it says a lot about the coronavirus epic in which we live, doesn't it?
It really does, Jared. And I think Nike is a perfect example of one of these major apparel companies that has taken learnings from earlier on during the pandemic and really used those to become a stronger company and a company that may even continue to grow in its prominence as we head out into this post-pandemic era. And taking a look at these results, we saw Nike actually return to sales growth for that quarter ending in November after reporting declines in each of those previous two quarters. And we saw the May quarter really the dire one here for Nike. We saw sales down 38% during that quarter. The company reported a loss. So that's something that we really tend to not see here for this company. And the big driver of growth for Nike had been digital sales as well as sales growth out of China. Now, on the digital sales side, this is something that we've seen across the board among retail giants, apparel makers. It really is all about having that e-commerce direct-to-consumer channel in order to really prop up and maintain these sales. And we actually, what's interesting about Nike is that digital sales growth accelerated in the November quarter to 84% year over year, even though the quarter also saw a broader reopening of its brick and mortar locations. So what that really says to investors and to consumers is that e-commerce and digital purchasing is really the future here. I mean, even more so than we maybe anticipated heading into the pandemic. Even as stores are reopening, consumers are getting accustomed to making their purchases via smartphone or via their laptop, as opposed to going in person in order to make these purchases. And this is likely a trend that's here to stay.
Speaking of trends that are here to stay, I've been watching with interest what's going on in the Treasury market and a yield curve that is steepening. And it's actually, on the one hand, it's doing precisely what you would expect in an environment where stocks are rallying and the Wall Street is broadly anticipating stronger economic growth for 2021. So on the one hand, you know, people are rotating a little bit out of safe haven debt and into stocks. But at the same time, you know, it seems like bond investors are really starting to pick up expectations for inflation. So you're seeing a lot of steepening between the spreads. A 2-year, 10-year spread is now a little over 82 basis points. It's steepest since October 2017. The 2-year to 30-year spread, at least 157 basis points. And that's the steepest since May of 2017. So these are really wide, given all that's going on, all that has transpired over this year, and a Fed that, you know, was aggressively, unapologetically dovish. I watch the yields and I wonder if there is something that in bond investors are trying to tell us, either about the inflationary outlook or maybe the debt and deficit spending, which we don't talk a lot about enough, or it doesn't seem to matter in the context of multi-trillion dollar deficits and a spending package that is designed at this point to support a coronavirus hit economy. So these things are things that I think we should be paying a little bit more attention to. I do think that there's a risk that bond investors get a little bit ahead of themselves and probably a little bit ahead of the Fed if they start overpricing inflation expectations rather. So I'm going to keep watching this, and I think that everybody else should start paying a little bit more closer attention to it as well.
Ooh, I agree, Javier. You got to watch those bond vigilantes, and I think we're in for a reckoning someday, but probably not in the near future. And that's just the thing. It's been difficult to pinpoint exactly when deficits, or if and when deficits, are going to matter again. In the current near ZERP environment, it just doesn't. But you know, things don't stay that way forever. Well, I want to stick with the Fed here because we got some late breaking news Friday afternoon. Results of the big bank stress test, and the Fed has given the green light for these firms to recommence their buybacks, their share buybacks. And this has been a source of contention for a lot of people following what's going on inside the banking industry, along with the Federal Reserve monetary policy, and exactly what you've been talking about, Javier, with fiscal policy. Is it the right thing to do? Well, dividends are currently frozen, so that hasn't changed. They can still offer dividends, but they can't increase them. But we are in the midst of new lockdowns across the world and in some places in the U.S. as well. And you got to wonder if these banks are, in fact, adequately capitalized to survive another downturn. I don't think we're going to see anything like we did in March or April, and banks are probably much better positioned than they were during that time. So it might be okay, but you can imagine there's going to be a lot of pushback on this. I'm going to go straight to you, Javier, again. So what's your take on this?
Yeah, on the one hand, I think that the Fed is, this is almost a full-throated endorsement of how well the sector has remained, how healthy they've remained, rather, in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. All of the banks are well-capitalized. In past stress tests, they've actually gone out of their way to single out some of the worst offenders. I mean, Citigroup springs to mind. They've really had a rough time since the 2008 crisis. So this time around, they were like, okay, they really did. Aside from maybe two or three offenders like HSBC and PNC, they're actually pretty complementary. So the banks have done quite well in terms of how they've been able to fare. JP Morgan, I think Q3, if I'm not mistaken, had a record quarter. They were the first out of the gate to announce that they were going to buy back their shares as soon as the Fed decided that they were going to loosen restrictions. So yeah, they've done well. But on the other hand, like, we're not through this crisis yet. So, you know, the only thing that you can expect is the unexpected at this point. And so whether or not that means and then again, like, looking at interest rates, we were just talking about interest rates. Does that pose a risk to the banks? Who knows? So there are things that could come out of us. There's the, you know, the dreaded black swan. And I don't want to be too dramatic, but I do believe that there are risks ahead. And I certainly hope that this decision isn't premature.
Definitely, Javier. And I think that decision by JP Morgan's board to immediately authorize new share buybacks of $30 billion and start that repurchasing plan in the first quarter of next year really speaks to how eager these big banks were to start returning capital to shareholders in the form of these buyback programs. And this had been one of the key factors weighing on financials over the course of 2020. We know that financials as a sector have sharply underperformed the broader market alongside the energy sector. And in absence of some of these programs in order to return value to shareholders, it just made so many of these companies and so many of these companies' stocks, rather, that much less appealing to investors. And in addition, of course, to what we were talking about with low interest rates this year, all factors, of course, weighing on these big banks. But I think the broader message that the Fed sent in these results is the clear indication that it believes things are on the upswing for the U.S. economy. And that was evident not just in the results of this stress test as it related to banks specifically, but also with what the Fed said in its monetary policy statement and in its new projections that we got out last Wednesday. I mean, the FOMC actually upgraded its median expectation for real GDP in the U.S. to grow by 4.2% in 2021. That's up from its 4% projection previously from September. It also upgraded its expectation for the unemployment rate, so it expects that to now come in lower than previously. And overall, I think we really are starting to get signs here from the Federal Reserve that, yes, things are still dire and there is still this winter to get through and there is still the period before we have widespread vaccinations. But on the whole, perhaps there is now light at the end of the tunnel here. And I think the Fed stress test results really speak to bolster that message.
Yeah, it's an interesting take, Emily, and I got to agree with you there. It really is a stamp of approval by the Federal Reserve on the economy, despite the current, well, let's call it a little bit more than a hiccup that we're facing. All right, I want to transition from banks to chips because Microsoft might be entering the chip space, designing its own chips for use in its cloud servers. And this is a big deal, kind of echoes of Apple introducing its own chips to run its iPhones. And guess who the big loser is? Intel, down 6% on Friday. AMD was also down, so same with Xilinx. But I see this as part of a bigger trend in the industry. Most of these most of the chip companies that we know, like NVIDIA, what have you, they don't make their own chips. They farm this out. Taiwan Semi does a lot of them. And so the space has just evolved where if you can simply design your chips, you have somebody else build them. And that's what a lot of these big guys are doing now. You got Microsoft, Apple in the space. Got to wonder if Alphabet is going to get into it. Maybe even Amazon. They could certainly use some of their own chips in AWS. So interesting, interesting situation here, guys.
Yeah, absolutely, Jared. And I think that comparison to the move that we saw from Apple is really a powerful one because, of course, we saw Apple just recently moving away from those Intel chips that it used for the better part of the past two decades or so in favor of its own in-house processors here that it claims to be faster, to integrate better with its suite of products. And now to see Microsoft actually make a similar move, I think really does sound the alarm here for some of these other chip makers like Intel, like you mentioned, which had been the company that so many of these big tech giants had relied on in years past. But at the same time, I think the semiconductor space as a whole still just has so much room to run when we think about the broader adoption of 5G technology, of course. That's something that's going to impact not just these big tech companies, but telecommunications, of course. If we think about even the push towards AI and automation, that's all going to rely heavily on these chips as well. So certainly still room for a lot of these companies to have major customer bases going forward if we want to think about that future addressable market here for companies like Intel, like Taiwan Semiconductor, like AMD. And again, a lot of these companies have been among the best performers so far over the past couple of years now, with the chip makers specifically. And that, you know, Philadelphia Semiconductor ETF continues to make fresh record highs, it seems, alongside the S&P 500. So still a lot of room to run here. But again, a warning sign that some of these big players here are shifting to their own in-house chips.
In that context, I mean, we're right around the corner from 2021 when Apple is going to release their first, as you mentioned, their first chip. And it almost makes me wonder if the emphasis is going to shift when we talk about Apple. We're constantly harping on iPhones, right? And now more recently we're talking a lot about their services revenue. But does this put Apple, or will this move that we're widely anticipating put Apple in that whole space when we talk about semiconductors, Intel, Qualcomm, so forth? Does it make the MacBook a bigger deal than what it is? You know, Apple is synonymous with the iPhone. But this move that Apple is poised to make, in large measure, is meant to integrate their entire suite of hardware. And they're obviously competing against some big dogs. So if they're not using Intel anymore and they're relying on their own in-house chips, how do we value Apple? How do we evaluate its business? Does this become like another, yet another business line, or things that those of us that watch these things have to think about? And I wonder if we're giving it short shrift, because I think it might even have bigger implications beyond just what we're discussing here in terms of the competitors. I mean, do we really have to rethink how we think about Apple?
I'm going to start rethinking how I think about Apple right now, because what was their motto back in the day? Think different. Well, we've been talking about the big tech giants getting into chip stocks, and also the Fed finally letting banks buy back some of their own shares after a brief hiatus due to coronavirus, and also the beginning of winter. It is upon us, along with Tesla in the S&P 500, as we await the ever elusive stimulus. This is a Market Wake Up. I'm Jared Blickery, along with Emily McCormick and Javier DeVee. Have a great day.